Good evening. I'm Lee Brissetti, Executive Director of Poets House, a literary center in Soho and a 45,000-volume poetry library, one of the world's great places for poetry. Before I say a few words of thanks to tonight's collaborators, I want to invite you all to visit us at 72 Spring Street. It is a place of inspiration and a place of nurture where you can feast on the work of Frank O'Hara and enjoy all other manner of breakfast, lunch, and dinner poems. This is the last event in a three-part series of programs about Frank O'Hara's brilliant and exuberant work. There is such a sense in his oeuvre of intimate connection and charged conversation between poets and painters that it's a particular pleasure to have worked with partner organizations on this festival to open our conversation about Frank O'Hara further. On Tuesday night, Bill Berkson, who has been such a generous convening presence, gave a talk about O'Hara's work at the Poets House Reading Room. Last night, in what can only be described as a poetry love fest, scores of writers read O'Hara's poems and selections from prose pieces to an entirely packed house at the Poetry Project of St. Mark's Church on the Bowery. I want to pass on special and warm thanks to all the readers and especially to Anselm Berrigan, director of the Poetry Project. Finally, I want to acknowledge the staff of MoMA for opening their new facilities to us and sharing some of the archives O'Hara treasures, some of which we can only imagine Frank O'Hara working on after drinking a papaya juice on his lunch hour after ambling down these very surrounding streets. Warm thanks to Laura Bayless for welcoming us, and to all of you for being here to share your enthusiasm for this remarkable artist. Laura Bayless is going to come up now. She's the host of the evening.
Thank you, Lee. Good evening, and welcome to the Museum of Modern Art and the first program in our new series, Modern Poets. I'm Laura Bayless, Associate Educator in the Department of Education, and I'm delighted to see all of you here to celebrate Frank O'Hara. Poetry at MoMA has a long tradition dating back to the 1950s when Frank O'Hara was an Associate Curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum. Poetry readings organized under the auspices of different directors from the 50s through the mid-90s brought leading poets to the museum, nurturing the natural bond between visual artists and poets. In an effort to revitalize O'Hara's legacy and MoMA's historical commitment to poetry, Modern Poets invites poets to bring the literary tradition back to the museum's collection. Three times a year, poets read historical works and their own work that reflects on modern and contemporary art. As Lee mentioned, tonight is the last event in the Frank O'Hara Festival. And tonight, finally, we have the opportunity to hear anecdotes and reflections and to look through the Frank O'Hara papers in the museum archives. There is nothing more exciting than launching poetry in our new Coleman Education and Research Building with a celebration of Frank O'Hara. I also would like to thank the Poetry Project and Poets House for approaching us as collaborators. And before introducing our participants this evening, I'd like to tell you that we have poets John Ashbery and Bill Berkson, artist and filmmaker Alfred Leslie, and museum archivist Michelle Elgott, who will share their memories and reflections on Frank O'Hara through brief remarks. Afterwards, you're all invited to proceed to the sixth floor to the library and archives reading rooms for an archival viewing of the museum's Frank O'Hara papers, available thanks to Maureen O'Hara, and for a wine reception. And so before we begin with our speakers, we're going to open the program with a short film clip from USA Poetry, Frank O'Hara and Ed Sanders, which was first broadcast on September 1st, 1966 on WNET and features Alfred Leslie. So here's our film. Thanks. Um, So now I wanted to give you our presenters. We'll first hear from Bill Berkson, then Alfred Leslie, then John Ashbery, and then Michelle Alagot. I would love to take the time to read their bios, but you have them in your programs. I'm sure you know almost all of what you need to know about them. And because we have so much to get through this evening, I'd ask you to hold your questions. We're going to have, as I mentioned before, a reception upstairs on the sixth floor, so you have time for a discussion later. Thanks, Bill.
You asked me to follow that act. Impossible. Okay, I have a prepared text, which I'll cut to fit it anyway, if it needs to be cut. This is pretty much about Frank O'Hara at the Museum of Modern Art and what I know about it, having been a relative latecomer to it all. This is how I first met Frank at a big artists and writers party at Joe Hazen and Jane Feiliker's house in 1959. But the beginning of our friendship dates from our coinciding a year and a half later in Paris, October 1960, actually, when Frank stopped there on the way back from Spain, where he had traveled accompanied by John Ashbery to research the new Spanish painting and sculpture show for this museum. A postcard he wrote, care of American Express, letting me know how to reach him in Paris, ended with a characteristic flourish, a quote from Bertolt Brecht, where will we all be on coronation day? Frank worked every day at MoMA, and his friends used to drop in and visit him and sometimes have lunch at nearby restaurants. The first time I did so, we went with Diane de Prima to P.J. Moriarty's, which was a kind of glorified working man's bar and grill. Later on, the scene shifted to La Raye's, a nice bistro on 55th Street, where André Breton and other immigrant surrealists used to gather in the 1940s. Long lunches, sometimes with lots of drinks, often followed by a stroll around the galleries. Frank's office was tiny for the two big desks, his and René News. It was in the old 21 West 53rd Street building, a former townhouse. Visitors applied for entry via the receptionist at what was known as the 21 desk. One window facing an air shaft, a door with a clear glass panel. There are photographs by Renata Ponsel Motherwell of Frank looking through that panel. Down the hall, Porter McCrae's office and Waldo Rasmussen's. This was the offices of the international program. Frank was devoted to the museum as the vehicle for modern art in America. It appealed to his sense of show business. He treated the place as an accessible version of the 1930s Warner Brothers lot with an admixture of the doings of the court at Versailles. The household deities were Alfred Barr and Dorothy Miller, and at some distance, Dorothy Miller's husband, Holger Cahill. For its part, the museum, meaning the administration and trustees, knew that Frank was their chance for immediate access to the downtown art scene in terms the artists could appreciate. He could talk to them as a colleague and neighbor rather than a critic or entrepreneur. He was the liaison, the conduit between corporate MoMA and the artists. The older artists, de Kooning, Rothko, etc., had had a long history of being snubbed by the museum during the years when MoMA's recognition might have meant the difference between total isolation and poverty and a modicum of stature in the larger world. Frank was more than a conduit, of course. As curator, he was exquisitely professional, all the more so because he had such a strong sense of occasion. But if he was useful as a conduit, it is important to understand why. Why precisely the artists both recognized him as kindred spirit and trusted his view of things. The answer, I think, is found partly in Morton Feldman's account, Lost Times and Future Hopes. Feldman says that part of what made Frank extraordinary was the sense that he actually wanted you to be great, that that was part of his grand scheme for you and himself and the world as he imagined it. This is a quote from Feldman's memoir. To us, he seemed to dance from canvas to canvas, from party to party, from poem to poem, a Fred Astaire with the whole art community as his Ginger Rogers. Yet I know if Frank could give me one message from the grave as I write this, he would say, "Don't tell them what kind of man I was, Morty. Did I do it? Never mind the rest." It's interesting to consider Allen Ginsberg's contrary view of Frank's uptown MoMA coordinates in his elegy, Ginsberg's elegy. The mixed with money and if you wanted your walls to be bare riffs from Allen's staunchly downtown point of view. Such disparagement was amplified, though from a very different perspective, by Virgil Thompson, whose only commentary on Frank posthumously was the bitter one that he had been taken in by, quote, the modern art racket, by which he meant the museum that had spurned after embracing the neo-romantics Chelyachev, Berman, Maurice Grosser, et alia, whom Virgil favored. The museum provided a forum, in a way, for Frank's courtliness, his sense of occasion, as well as his fatal charm and love of gossip and intrigue. The meetings, receptions, the installations and openings of shows, all Byzantine in the maneuverings to get the thing envisioned done, all got his movie-fed blood going. The hard part was writing the catalog essays, which he tended to sweat out at home, always at the last minute or later. I don't believe that working for MoMA hampered Frank's ability to write. For one thing, all that writing on the job, writing the lunch poems, for instance, gave what poems he wrote there a clandestine edge they might otherwise have lacked. But eventually, the combination of his museum days, his nights of heavy socializing and dissipation, his complicated friendships and love affairs exhausted him. Finally, it was all too much. In 1964, Frank invited me to make a selection of Robert Motherwell's writings for the catalog accompanying the retrospective he was organizing at MoMA for the following year. Eventually, for the Nakian show and a grand David Smith project that somehow was never realized, my specialty became the compiling of the artist's chronology, or in a haughtier phrase, biographical outline. "His chronologies are very serious," Frank wrote in one of a set of Gertrude Stein books he gave me at the time. The great overseer, the in-house editor we all relied upon, was Helen Frank. In 1966, the prospect was a Jackson Pollock exhibition, the first since the original one that had been in progress when Pollock died 10 years previous. Here are two relevant entries from my journal that year, and they sort of give a flavor of, you know, what Frank was doing and what the atmosphere at the museum and also in the art world generally was at the time. July 7, 1966. A week ago, Helen Frank suggested that notes be kept on the preparation for the Pollock exhibition to be held at MoMA next March. She and Frank and I discussed the quarrels and controversies we'd be revitalizing. Peggy Guggenheim, Lee Pollock, Barney Newman, who claims his blood is literally in blue poles, the de Kooning Pollock rivalry between avatars and critics. Yesterday at lunch with Frank and Helen Frankenthaler, Frank was visibly nervous, hands shook, lifting his first Negroni to his lips. Later, he said he always feels extreme nervousness before such important shows. He had met with Bill Lieberman, who was then a major curator at the museum, who now insists that Frank be director of the whole show, with Lieberman just supplying his half, the drawings. Frank said the promises he had made to Lieberman made him nervous because now he wasn't sure he could meet them. The deadline for the catalog material is October 1st. I will write the biographical outline and assist in research. Frank says Osorio has promised to lend not only Lavender Mist, but 5 other paintings as well. On top of all this, Willem de Kooning has agreed to a retrospective at the museum with Frank directing in 1968. "If you do it, okay," is what Master Bill said to Frank on the beach at East Hampton last weekend. Six days later, July 13th, lunch with Frank. He talked of Lee Pollack and perhaps she and I should talk soon. I suggested that I not meet her until I have studied the Pollack background material more thoroughly. He tells me she is pleased I am doing it. Some attractive paintings by her at Marlborough in a summer show. Frank still seems distracted. Noticed a slight tremble in one hand at lunch, at which he gave me a little bemused side glance. Helen Frank is not editing the catalog material. How come? Lee Pollack has vetoed the inclusion of appreciations by former colleagues, Newman, Tony Smith, de Kooning, etc., in the catalog, and so forth. 2 weeks later, July 5th, 1966, Frank was gone. July 25th, 1966. Bill Lieberman organized the whole Pollack show. Tom Hess took over the de Kooning. And although Lieberman relieved me of my biographical outline duties on the Pollack, I continued as a guest editor in the publications department until 1969. The book the museum did in Frank's honor a year after his death in memory of my feelings still looks appropriate, although I have changed my mind 100 times since about what poems should add up to the 30 included in it. The 30 artists involved were the right ones. Alfred Leslie might want to tell how he graciously agreed to alter one or two of his drawings when the inevitable obscenity card turned up at an early production meeting. Finally, all the artworks, all done on Mylar sheets with the poems laid out in advance, were in, and looking at them in René Dornancourt's outer office, Bill Lieberman asked, "What if I were to write the artists asking each to donate each one set to the museum to be exhibited only in Frank's memory?" In short, they did. 18 de Kooning drawings, a comparable number of Augustine's, beauties by Johns, Oldenburg, Leslie, Freilacher, Katz, Frankenthaler, Newman, Rauschenberg, Rivers, Brainerd, Button, Krasner, Marisol, and more. Finally, the relation of the museum to Frank's writing is a fascinating one, and actually one not much explored. As René New says in her memoir, when Frank was at his desk behind her, she couldn't see whether he was, quote, drafting a letter, working on an introduction, or writing a poem. One day in December 1956, Frank wrote 2 poems inspired by pictures on view in the MoMA galleries, a Pollack and Augustine. The Pollack poem eventually found its way into Frank's Pollack monograph some years later. The Guston is interesting because it represents the idea that whatever one thinks about in front of an artwork is a valid understanding response to the work. I'm going to read that poem. It's untitled. And actually, there are 2 versions of it. This is the one I prefer. It seems far away and gentle now, the morning miseries of childhood, and its raining calms over the schools, alterable noons of loitering beside puddles, watching leaves swim, and reflected dreams of blue travels, to be always in vigilance, away from the bully who broke my nose, so I had to break his wristwatch. I hit him, it fell off, and I stepped on it, so whenever, wherever he was, he would never again know the time. A surprising violence in the sky inspired me to my first public act, nubile and pretentious, but growing pure as the white caps are the winds, but a surface agitation of the waters means a rampart on the ocean floor is falling. I think you can see the ramparts in the Philip Guston painting, which actually is upstairs. It's a painting called Painting, dated 1954. One last item. In 1964, the museum asked Frank if he would reply to questions about modern art posed by teenagers who had visited the galleries. The questions and Frank's answers were published in the December issue of Ingenue magazine as Teens Quiz a Critic, What's With Modern Art? Question. I'm just going to read one Q&A. Question, Is it in poor taste to admire and like an artist who is still alive and near to the art world, especially if what he paints appeals to teenagers in style and color? That's from Jane Coe Salmi, Morristown High School, New Jersey. This is Frank's answer, and it's the last thing I'll read. It is never in poor taste to admire anyone except possibly Hitler. It is important to admire an artist while he is still alive so that he may have some pleasure and comfort as a result of his efforts. If what he paints appeals to teenagers, it should hardly be held against him. Since teens are the future and an integral part of his audience, thanks. I think John Ashbery is next up. No? Oh, Alfred Leslie is next up.
That was really great. I don't have any prepared statements to make. I just thought I would wing it as I come here, as I came here, look into all of your faces and sort of absorb everything that went on before me here. And what it occurs to me after seeing all this is that I realize, if I may talk about this in relationship to myself, that I have thought about Frank every single day of my life ever since practically I met him. In 1952, when he first came here in New York, the occasion of my meeting him was, as it were, accidental. I was asking John Ashbery about it a moment ago, because trying to remember exactly the circumstances. And as I remember it now, my dealer at the time, a man named John Myers, who founded a gallery named Thibaut Denagi, had an apartment on St. Mark's Place or 8th Street, as John, I think, remembered. And he had a garden apartment, and he was an entrepreneur, a poet, writer. He started the gallery. And he liked to have these Thursday or Friday evenings, which he had held as a kind of salon. And he would invite all the poets and writers and painters that he knew and bring them all together in this apartment. I was a young artist at the time, maybe 24 years old or something like that. And some of the things that John would like to do, besides asking me to take off my clothes and stand there and show my muscles, because I used to be a gymnast, was sometimes he would ask me to sing, and I would oblige him. One of my favorite songs to sing was Hoagie Carmichael's Hong Kong Blues, which to this day I still remember all of the words. But another thing that John always liked to do was to have sort of a poetry fest. And what he would do, he had this one evening when I met Frank, there was a big table in the living room, and John, I think, was living with a guy named Waldemar Hansen at the time. And they put a big wine bottle, and they sort of played a spin-the-bottle game. And the spin-the-bottle game, rather than pointing to sexual partners or anything like that, was it points to you and you have to recite a line of poetry. So, of course, here I am. I was surrounded by all of these poets who were educated. I'm basically an autodidact. Took Frank to explain to me in 1960 when I was editing a play of Malkasham by Derek Walcott. I called Frank up and I said, what's the difference? What's a colon? What's the difference between a colon and a semicolon? And he said, a colon is a stop sign and a semicolon is a blinking light. So that's where I was. So I'm there and the bottle spins around, and instead of stopping at Chester Coleman, or I'm not sure whether Auden was there, I think he lived across the street. I know that Allen Ginsberg was there. I don't remember if John was there or not. It's very early, 1952, and it stops on me. I have to come up with a a line of poetry or something. So I thought, what do I know? I mean, I know all these songs. All I could think of, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. I said, no, that's too simple. Everybody knows that first line. Then I think of another one. Margaret, are you grieving over? No, I know that. Everybody knows that one. That's too easy. But all this is going on very fast through my head. And then all of a sudden I said, tardily I arch my back and purr deep-throated approval for Val Luton's Curse of the Cat People. And then I looked around. I saw blank faces. Nobody recognized the quote except this young, skinny guy who was sitting there, and it was Frank, who said, James Agee, review in the Nation of Val Luton's The Curse of the Cat People. Or the Cat People, was it? Yeah. At that point, we didn't know each other. We got to talking a little bit later, but we didn't actually become friends after that, except everywhere I went after that, no matter where I came to the museum, whether what bar I went to, no matter day or night, I always ran into Frank. We were creatures with wild hormones, and we were also creatures who had wild longings to make things. For years, I ran into Frank in this way. Finally, at about the time of 1963, when I began thinking about making the film, the first film that Frank and I made together, The Last Clean Shirt, we saw each other regularly, but I wasn't the kind of person who got on the telephone, called anybody, and certainly in terms of drinking, I couldn't keep up with anybody. I was a very restless and wretched drunk, actually. At any rate, Frank and I worked on The Last Clean Shirt, which is, I brought 4 minutes of footage and show you sort of a minute of the four or five films that Frank worked on together. Now, at the beginning of this, we'll show that in a second. I told you that I thought about Frank every day of my life, but also at the last point in Frank's life, our lives became incredibly connected, because in the footage that you saw before that Frank elected to have shot in my studio, no more than 2 months later, 3 months later, on October 17th, 1966, a fire started and burned down that studio, and 12 firemen were killed. I think all of you may have seen in the last anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the death of those 12 firemen. Was a memorial service held, and there was a lot of New York City here held on the news about it. For me, in that sense, I became embedded, in a sense, in Frank's life, and our lives became embedded. That picture of us together, the only pictures that remain of my work at that time was as a consequence of Frank's beauty and generosity in stepping forward and saying to these people when they wanted to make this film, let's go over to Alfred's studio. Because in a way, what Frank was so inclusive, as Bill pointed out, and as John knows, with those of us who knew him, knew an incredible human being, inclusive in every way imaginable, with tremendous generosity to all the people that he knew. It's great to have known him. And his wretched death is really something that to this day still makes me very angry. So if thems that's up there want to show this brief clips that I prepared for you yesterday, DVD master, thank you.
Thank you. Voluptuaries of all ages, of every sex, it is to you only that I offer this work. Nourish yourselves upon its principles. They favor your passions, and those passions whereof coldly insipid moralists put you in fear are naught but the means nature employs to bring man to the end she prescribes to him. Hearken only to these delicious promptings, for no voice save that of the passions can conduct you to happiness. You women, let the voluptuous Solange be your model. After her example, be heedless of all that contradicts pleasure's divine laws, by which all her life she was enchained. You young maidens, too long constrained by her fanciful virtues absurd. Voluptuaries of all ages, of every sex, it is to you only that I offer this work. Nourish yourselves upon its principles. They favor your passions, and those passions whereof coldly insipid moralists put you in fear are naught but the means nature employs to bring man to the end she prescribes to him. Hearken only to these delicious promptings, for no voice save that of the passions can conduct you to happiness. You women, let the voluptuous Solange be your model. After her example, be heedless of all that contradicts pleasure's divine laws, by which all her life she was enchained. You young maidens, too long constrained by her fanciful virtue's absurd and dangerous bonds, and by those of a disgusting religion, imitate the fiery Eugenie. Voluptuaries of all ages, of every sex, it is to you only that I offer this work. Nourish yourselves upon its principles. They favor your passions, and those passions whereof coldly insipid moralists put you in fear are naught but the means nature employs to bring man to the end she prescribes to him. Hearken only to these delicious promptings, for no voice save that of the passions can conduct you to happiness. You women, let the voluptuous Solange be your model. After her example, be heedless of all that contradicts pleasure's divine laws, by which all her life she was enchained. You young maidens, too long constrained by her fanciful virtue's absurd and dangerous bonds, and by those of a disgusting religion, imitate the fiery Eugene.
Thank you. It's actually exactly 55 years ago this month that Frank began to work at the Museum of Modern Art as selling Christmas cards. And we were all very happy and envious that he'd found a job, never realizing what it would become over the years. I had met Frank 2 years before when we were both at Harvard in the spring of 1949. Is it possible not to flash those things in my eyes, please? There goes another one. I guess one has to put up with these things these days. Where was I? I was just about to graduate when I first met him, although I knew very well who he was. I had been seeing him around Cambridge for the last couple of years, and I was on the Harvard Advocate, which published some of his poems and also his fiction. And I never felt I could go up and introduce myself to him because he had a rather intimidating look, as you probably noticed. He had a broken nose that suggested he might have broken it in a boxing match. And it wasn't until I went to a small exhibition of work by Edward Gorey, who at that time was
was Frank's roommate in Elliott House. They weren't particularly close, but they were roommates. And I overheard him talking about a concert of Poulenc that had taken place a couple of nights before, in which he said, let's face it, Les Sécheresses, the name of the Poulenc work, is greater than Tristan. And I said, hey, that's the sort of thing that I say, and you sound like me anyway. And in fact, as you might have noticed, we did have a very similar voice and accent, which was surprising since we didn't grow up in the same part of the country. I grew up in Western New York State, and he in Massachusetts. The following, or actually 2 years later, I'm getting a little ahead, Frank, on his way back from his year at the University of Michigan, where he got an MA, stopped and stayed with me and my family and in New York State for a few days. And one day, or one evening rather, he went into the kitchen where my mother was washing dishes and said, oh, can I help you? And my mother, without looking around, said, no, John, go back to your guests, because there, she thought it was me. And we also could, on the phone, our voices were really identical, and we sometimes purposely impersonated each other to confuse people. When I first met him, Frank was, I think, reading a bunch of books by writers I had never heard of, some that I had heard of, but not the ones that were being taught at Harvard by any means. There was Samuel Beckett, who was really unknown at that time. It was long before Godot. Jean Rhys, Flann O'Brien, who wrote At Swim Two Birds, Mayakovsky, and Ronald Furbank. And I was very intrigued by these writers who I vaguely had heard of, including Furbank, and I said, but this is kind of silly and frivolous. Is it really okay to read this kind of stuff? And he said, yeah, go ahead. He's actually a great writer. And I began reading him, and I immediately agreed that he was great and that I was, I had to change my aesthetic attitude and appreciate things that you're not supposed to, like another example being Rachmaninoff, who was one of Frank's great passions. And it was very liberating to learn from him that one could actually like the things that one really liked and not pretend. Anyway, so we saw as much as we could of each other during that brief period. After I graduated, I came to New York and got a job in the Brooklyn Library. Frank had a year at University of Michigan and arrived subsequently and ended up at MoMA. And he was also very shortly after that reviewing exhibitions for Art News and getting to know a lot of the painters. I never really knew them very well, except for Larry, Jane, Alfred, Grace, but I didn't know Pollock and de Kooning and Newman and so on. I think they identified me as the guy who was always tagging along with Frank, sometimes at the Cedar Bar. After several years of working in publishing, I got a Fulbright to France, and I ended up staying away for actually 10 years from 1955 to 1965, so I really missed a very crucial period in America. It was like the button-down 50s when I left, and when I came back, the 60s were almost over, and the shambles of America were in even worse decline, and it was great. We were always our general aesthetic was pretty similar, but we argued about people individually. Like, he liked Schoenberg and I liked Berg. He preferred Shostakovich. I liked Prokofiev. I guess I sort of lost out on that one. I preferred Pasternak to Mayakovsky, Proust to Joyce. And our attitude as far as poetry went, we were dissatisfied, as was Kenneth Koch and James Schuyler, with the accepted poetry aesthetic of that time, and were much more interested in European writers, well, Pasternak, Rimbaud, who were some of the others? and also in music and of course in the visual arts, there wasn't anything really similar happening in poetry. And our aim was to sort of bring this experimentation into poetry and see how we could do that, how that would work. I missed very much seeing him when I was in Europe. At that time, one communicated, of course, by airmail, which could take months to arrive, and many of the letters I got from him were written on Museum of Modern Art stationery and included poems. I remember one in particular, a poem called Louise, which actually, as he said in the letter, was about a louse that I discovered on my very own distinguished person in the men's room of the museum a few minutes ago. I saw him a few times. Once, well, there was a big traveling European show of the New York School, Pollock, Rothko, de Kooning, et cetera, and it was at the museum, what is now the Musée d'Art Moderne de Paris. I guess it was then too, actually. It was before, long before Pompidou, and I was hired by Porter McRae, Frank's superior, to help translate to the workmen and where they wanted things hung, and I got to help make out a guest list for the big dinner they had celebrating this event at the Closerie des Lilas, and was able to put in a lot of people that I'd been wanting to meet in Paris, but unsuccessfully, such as, I remember the writer Michel Butor, who I wanted to see for some research I was doing, and who had never answered my letters, and I was, therefore, I seated myself next to him at the dinner, pester him. And also the trip to Spain when Frank chose work for the large show of Spanish art, which I never did see since I didn't come back to New York for at that time. But it was my the first time I ever went to Spain. I went there on the train and met him, and we were obviously all the artists in Madrid were wining and dining him, and I got to get invited out too. Then we went to Barcelona and met more artists, all of the Gaudi buildings and even the Colonia Güell, which is a kind of a colony outside of, artist colony outside of Barcelona, ending up in San Sebastian, where the sculptor Chiida entertained us. And since we were so close, we went to Biarritz, where I was able to find the summer home of Raymond Roussel, which I had been looking for unsuccessfully, and nobody up until then had been able to identify it. And so it was a wonderful trip for me. And then when I came, I moved back to New York at the end of 1965, and in November, and only had a short time then to see Frank, and unfortunately didn't get to see him nearly as much as I wanted to. By that time, he was very busy at the museum. He was arranging exhibitions. There were always foreign curators who were passing through, and unfortunately, the last time that I could have seen him was for lunch in July of 1966, and I actually canceled that because I was going on vacation the next week and had a lot of things, details to clean up at Art News, where by that time I was working. So we didn't go to Larrey's that day, and that would have been the last time I would have seen him, and I, of course, have always regretted that. I think I'll conclude by reading one of his poems, which I am very proud of, because I remember when he wrote it, we always showed each other our poems, and also with Kenneth, it was the only time in my life, actually, where I've discussed poetry with fellow poets and gotten input and ideas, and after a while, it seemed we all decided we didn't need it anymore, but it was very good and useful while it happened. This was a poem that was actually lost, and I had typed it out from the copy that Frank lent me and sent it to Kenneth Koch, who was in Europe at the time, and who hadn't quite decided that we should allow Frank to join our exclusive group of two poets. And I was trying to persuade him, so I sent him a bunch of poems. And then after Frank died, there was no copy of this, but Kenneth had it in his papers, the copy that I had sent him. And I think, will show the kind of aesthetic we were, especially Frank was trying to develop. It was actually from him that we kind of took the lead in discovering new artists. He, as you see, he talks about a great many of them in this poem. And it's a kind of an artistic credo in a way, although he wouldn't have wanted me to use that term, I'm sure. Memorial Day, 1950. Picasso made me tough and quick, and the world. Just as in a minute plane trees are knocked down outside my window by a crew of creators. Once he got his axe going, everyone was upset enough to fight for the last ditch and heap of rubbish. Through all that surgery, I thought I had a lot to say, and named several last things Gertrude Stein hadn't had time for. But then the war was over, those things had survived, and even when you're scared, art is no dictionary. Max Ernst told us that. How many trees and frying pans I loved and lost. Actually, the frying pan was part of the kind of minimalist aesthetic of George Montgomery, a good friend of ours, who, and Frank had kind of decorated his room, or undecorated it. According to that, I remember he had a kind of army cot with an army blanket on it and a frying pan on the floor, which was an ashtray, and it was seemed terribly chic to me. How many trees and frying pans I loved and lost. Guernica hollered, "Look out." But we were all busy hoping our eyes were talking to Paul Klee. My mother and father asked me, and I told them from my tight blue pants, we should love only the stones, the sea, and heroic figures. Wasted child, I'll club you on the shins. I wasn't surprised when the older people entered my cheap hotel room and broke my guitar and my can of blue paint. At that time, all of us began to think with our bare hands and even with blood all over them. We knew vertical from horizontal. We never smeared anything except to find out how it lived. Fathers of Dada, you carried shining erector sets in your rough, bony pockets. You were generous, and they were lovely as chewing gum or flowers. Thank you. And those of us who thought poetry was crap were throttled by Auden or Rimbaud when, sent by some compulsive Juno, we tried to play with collages or Sprechstimme in their bed. Poetry didn't tell me not to play with toys, but alone I could never have figured out that dolls meant death. Our responsibilities did not begin in dreams, though they began in bed. Love is first of all a lesson in utility. I hear the sewage singing under my bright white toilet seat and know that somewhere, sometime, it will reach the sea. Gulls and swordfishes will find it richer than a river. And airplanes are perfect mobiles, independent of the breeze. Crashing in flames, they show us how to be prodigal. Oh, Boris Pasternak, it may be silly to call to you, so tall in the Urals, but your voice cleans our world, clearer to us than the hospital. You sound above the factory's ambitious gargle. Poetry is as useful as a machine. Look at my room. Guitar strings hold up pictures. I don't need a piano to sing, and naming things is only the intention to make things. A locomotive is more melodious than a cello. I dress in oilcloth and read music by Guillaume Apollinaire's Clay Candelabra. Now my father is dead and has found out you must look things in the belly, not in the eye. If only he had listened to the men who made us, hollering like stuck pigs. Thank you.
Allow me to begin by being frank. I did not know Frank O'Hara. While the possibility of travel back in time to meet him is not an option available to me, although I often do wish that such a thing were so, I have discovered a way to placate my hunger for learning just what happened in times of the past. Indeed, I have found a career. I am a treasure hunter, or what we around here more commonly call an archivist. As an archivist, I see myself akin to a modern archaeologist digging up clues to fully understand the events of the past and their context. It is by working directly with the original artifacts, the primary sources, that one can learn so much. As you know, the direct expression or documentation of a person can be very revealing. With these raw materials, as in the case of O'Hara, his endless lists and numerous exhaustively detailed memos, we can understand how almost compulsively thoughtful and organized O'Hara was with his work here at the museum. So I shall not attempt to talk directly about the person who so many of you here in this room have known, but rather I will talk about the archival materials that remain and hope that together we will see how they can document and elucidate this man and his very real contribution to the history of art of the mid-20th century. As you all know by now, toward the end of 1951, with the incentive of frequent visitation to Alfred Barr's Matisse retrospective here at the museum, O'Hara was very interested in taking a job at the front desk to sell books, postcards, etc. And he worked in that job until 1953 when he left the museum to devote himself to writing. But luckily for us, he returned to the museum in 1959 when he was hired into the international program by Porter McRae. The program's intent was to stimulate cultural exchange programs in the visual arts between the United States and other countries. O'Hara began as an administrative assistant in that program, but probably largely due to the combination of his fantastic eye and his organizational skills, he was soon organizing exhibitions, and by the time of his death, he was an associate curator in the Department of Painting and Sculpture. Helen Frank, who you've heard about already, spoke to us on the occasion of an oral history that we did in the museum archives, a commission to document an interview with her and others. She had explained of O'Hara, and I quote, "He was very close to the leading abstract expressionist painters and sculptors. He had this intense life with them and with people on Long Island, and nevertheless, he was absolutely, completely well-organized and efficient at his job. He was much better working with and meeting his deadlines than many of the staff. It was always a miracle to me he managed to do that. Maybe having been in the Navy helped, but he was remarkable in that way," she said. An example of this efficiency is seen in his first curatorial effort at the museum when in 1957 he directed the U.S. representation for the fourth Sao Paulo Biennale. And I'm showing you one of many, many, many long, detailed memos we have in the archives. The show at that time was divided into two sections. The first was a Jackson Pollock retrospective, whereby he basically took the Sam Hunter show of the year before and adapted it and made some pretty major changes, specifically in the inclusion of early and late Pollock work, and secondarily by adding works on paper. And here you see some of Frank's notes about the drawings that he wanted to include in the show. And by many accounts, this exhibition was much more successful than the original one. The second half of the Biennale show was a group exhibition of painting and sculpture by 8 artists. And here I'm just showing you some of Frank's notes where he's listing the artists that he wants to include in this exhibition. The following year, in 1958, the Pollock section from the Biennial was reborn as a new exhibition that traveled throughout Europe. And here you see an installation view of it at the Whitechapel Art Gallery. This same year, this is 1958, O'Hara's unerring eye was proven on two occasions. Following a visit to Jasper John's first solo exhibition at Leo Castelli, O'Hara writes to Barr, identifying his favorite works in the show. His number one choice, as perhaps you can read here, is The Green Target, which three weeks later Alfred Barr acquires for the MoMA collection. Later that year, O'Hara was responsible for a portion of the U.S. representation at the Venice Biennale. He selected works by Seymour Lipton and Mark Toby, and that year, Toby was the winner of the International Jury's Award. So I think you can see how his eye was right on. In 1959, he co-directed with Porter McCrae the U.S. representation at Documenta 2 in Kassel, Germany. The selection focused on abstract expressionists, such as those which were included in the pivotal New American Painting exhibition of the year before, which, by the way, you should know that that exhibition, which is one of the most important in the spread of abstract expressionism through to places outside of the United States, almost didn't happen due to some scheduling difficulties and whatnot. And it was largely through the intervention of O'Hara and his colleague Porter McCrae that they made it happen. Now, of significance to this Documenta 2 show, the exhibition also included the important and prescient editions of Hans Hoffmann and Robert Rauschenberg. And you see here O'Hara's notes, including that he's interested in thinking about including Rauschenberg. Rauschenberg was represented by bed in this exhibition, which, according to Waldo Rasmussen, quote, was a real shocker at the time. 1960 marked a turning point as it was the year O'Hara was named a curator and the first time he organized an exhibition held at the museum. There would be two others, Robert Motherwell and the Ruben Nakian exhibitions. This show was a bit of a departure for him, devoted as it was to new Spanish painting and sculpture. But really, the bulk of his career was devoted to showcasing the American artists of his day. In the interest of time, let's look at just three examples of these. First, in 1963, he directed a Franz Klein exhibition, which traveled in Europe until 1964. In addition to the scholarship, O'Hara was attentive to the attendant administrative matters that concern an exhibition, such as working with outside consultants, including our very own here, this letter from John Ashbery, who helped coordinate and have text translated, in addition to encouraging the artist's estate to send representatives to the opening. And here I'm just showing you two images of the opening of that exhibition. 2 years later, in 1965, O'Hara directed the important Robert Motherwell exhibition at MoMA, which subsequently traveled in Europe during 1966. O'Hara's papers include manuscript text about the artist, a brief quote from which I believe is here deserving. O'Hara wrote of Motherwell, "The other capital P in his work is poetry, the first one having been paper. Without being literary in content, his work continually reflects the importance of poetry in his life and art." The artist and curator enjoyed a relationship casual enough that Motherwell was comfortable writing to O'Hara. Oh, and actually you see, sorry, here, the artist and O'Hara. And this letter from Motherwell to O'Hara with his ideas about the best venue for his exhibition when it would travel to Italy later. Third, O'Hara directed the David Smith retrospective, which circulated in Europe 1966-67. This show benefited from the contribution of Bill Berkson, who was charged with writing the chronology section. We've heard a bit about that already. And here's a letter from Bill. And also, it prompted recollections of Smith by the artist Kenneth Noland. O'Hara had wanted to amplify the exhibition and stage it at MoMA in summer of 1967, but unfortunately this did not happen. Before I close, I would like to state how the archives can provide so much more than just all these facts and figures to help reconstruct a chronology. Here and there in the papers, one finds little nuggets that really round out our knowledge or understanding of events of days gone by. Whether it's a handwritten, synchronized schedule for three different exhibitions, you can see how he's plotting and scheming to make sure everything happens on schedule. Or a letter, half of a series of correspondence with Mercedes Matter, where they're discussing her strong interest in having more artists hired at the museum as security guards. And he says he would do his best to forward her request to the appropriate peoples. Or even the fact that he retained the all-staff memo informing the staff about the new coffee wagon that would make its rounds every morning to the administrative offices. Each of these documents reveals in a small way one of the many multiple facets that constructs a personality. So finally, I'd like to share with you some discoveries I made during the course of my research. One of which was mentioned already, though it was something I hadn't known about. In May of 1966, shortly before his death, O'Hara submitted four proposals for upcoming exhibitions. So the first one that we've already heard about, it was the Pollock Show. Oh, I'm sorry, here was another picture of him I wanted to show you. And this is the exhibition proposal form for the Pollock Show. And it was great to identify this and to hear the remarks about the fact that O'Hara was really the originator of this show, because I can tell you from the researchers who have visited us subsequently, many people don't know that fact and ascribe it mostly to Lieberman. The other proposal that I thought was quite interesting was this one for a Barnett Newman exhibition. And I just like the comments at the bottom, which I'll read for you. O'Hara wrote, "It could be one of the most beautiful exhibitions of the 20th century, I think, and a controversial one for the public in the sense of provocative and stimulating, leading to revaluations of what painting is." However, unfortunately, an exhibition devoted to Newman does not occur at the museum until 4 years later as a memorial to the artist. In closing, I would like to quote from Renee New, who, as we have heard, worked with O'Hara here at the museum. She said of him, "Somehow, the work got done. It always surprised me how the poet, the dreamer, the man about town would pay attention not just to the major problems, but to every tiny detail as well." So, after we're finished here, unless Laura has closing comments, I would like to invite you all of you who are interested in all those tiny details. We have many documents from the archival collections, all of the ones you've seen here, as well as many others, if you'd care to look at them more closely, upstairs. In addition, Mylon Houston has made a selection of books from the library collections, two of which I think are of, you know, specific interest that we have on display. If you'd like to see the A City Winter and Other Poems with the original drawing by Larry Rivers, as well as Oranges with the Grace Hardigan cover. They're really gems. So, thank you.